This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. I'm glad you're listening today. We'll head all around the state with music videos, co-housing, the gun debate, and the proposed natural gas pipeline. But we also aired the third installment of our food insecurity series this week, and I want to get right to it. One of the most hidden faces of food insecurity is that of the hungry child. WMRA's Jordy Yeager looks at efforts to help kids eat better, more regular meals, and to learn good eating habits.
Such a familiar noise. For many of us, it's probably far removed, but that's the sound of about 100 third and fifth graders eating lunch at school. In Albemarle County last year, about 20 of those voices belonged to kids from homes that didn't have adequate access to food. If you lived in Charlottesville, nearly 55 of those 100 children were considered food insecure. And that's just locally. A recent study by Feeding America, a nationwide nonprofit network of food banks, looked at central and western Virginia. They found that in 2013, more than 53,000 kids under the age of 18 weren't sure where they'd get their next meal. That number had grown by more than 1,300 kids since the previous year. Nationally, the group found that nearly one-third of the 49 million people who go hungry in the U.S. every month are children.
Children who are food insecure arrive at school far less prepared to learn.
Michael McKee, the chief executive officer of the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, explains the effects food insecurity has on children.
They have a much harder time attending to teachers. They might have a harder time staying awake. They're lower energy. They're more easily distracted. They're given to more frequent behavioral challenges. And they're likely to fall behind if not provided with sufficient food. And we know that kids who fall behind by third grade fall further behind and are at higher risk of dropping out of school.
To try and make sure that kids have enough to eat in these formative years, the federal government funds free and reduced lunch programs in schools throughout the country. In order to qualify for free meals, a family of four has to make less than $31,000. Last year, more than half of the 4,000 children enrolled in Charlottesville City schools received free or reduced lunch. That proportion has held steady since 2007, the year before the recession. Of course, some elementary schools in the system have higher rates, well over 80% most years, while others hover in the 30 to 40% range. In total, last year, Charlottesville City Schools provided roughly 375,000 lunches, 200,000 breakfasts, and 60,000 snacks to kids. But it's not just the quantity of meals that a child receives, it's also the quality. So within the sheer volume of food, Christina Connell tries to make sure that food insecure kids eat more healthfully. That means providing students with more fresh fruits and vegetables and fewer processed foods. That means preparing more foods in the school kitchen and ordering fewer frozen foods from a manufacturer. That means getting students to try new things, like kale chips or hummus or parfaits. That means the fryolators of my childhood have been replaced with salad bars. It hasn't been easy, says Connell, a coordinator of school nutrition for Charlottesville City Schools.
At least we're providing these meals that are nutritious, low in sodium, high in whole grains, at least a couple times a day to people that ordinarily wouldn't have that opportunity. And maybe in some way that'll make a difference.
Another way the schools are trying to make a difference is with vegetable gardens, like the one I visit at Clark Elementary, which has the highest free and reduced lunch rate in Charlottesville. As the kids try new foods like kale chips or asparagus, they also learn where it comes from and what it takes to grow it. The nonprofit group City Schoolyard Garden was started 5 years ago and now boasts educational gardens in 7 out of the 9 Charlottesville City schools. While nearly every student has a chance to get his or her hands dirty, the group is particularly focused on reaching kids from low-income and food-insecure households. About 2,500 kids participate in the gardens each year. But the program goes beyond teaching kids how to grow kale, asparagus, and dozens of other vegetables. Executive Director Jeanette Abinader explains.
Our vision is that children who are engaged in nature have enhanced academic performance. They learn, they cultivate healthy living skills. They learn about community teamwork. So we're using the garden as a lab.
The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank is trying to stem the tide of child hunger with its own program. It's called the Backpack Program, and it spans schools over 6 counties, especially those in rural areas. Eligible students get a backpack full of food every Friday during the school year. But McKee says we can't backpack our way out of child hunger. It's just not a cost-effective model, which leaves him wondering, what more can be done?
We've got to do more, and we've got to figure out how to get to the kids who need us most. How do we get to the kids who have even fewer options?
For WMRA News, I'm Jordy Yeager.
There's a good chance you've never attended a concert at the Garage in Charlottesville, in part because it is actually a one-car garage and easy to overlook. But now you can experience a bit of the Garage's magic online via a website that features its bands performing in iconic locations around town. Emily Richardson-Lorente has the story of the producers behind those videos.
Forrest and Zaina Pando spend a lot of time shooting and editing wedding videos.
Well, I want to find a moment where she like looks at him and smiles.
Yeah.
There we go. That's a nice little eyebrow raise smile.
It's their job, and they're great at it. But their passion? Music videos. They discovered that on the day they heard this lovely voice wafting through the open window of their production office. We're all alone on street
corner when the hail began to fall. Looked out the window and it was this guy and a girl. She was playing guitar, he was playing upright bass.
They sounded awesome and we were like, we should definitely film them right now instead of sitting here editing.
So the husband and wife wedding video team took a chance. They headed downstairs, sheepishly asked for permission to film, shot a few takes of the song, and then found out that the musicians, Rebecca Todd and Will Seymour, would be playing at the Garage that night.
When they said the Garage, both of us were like, is that a real place? Because, like, we'd never heard of it.
They'd never heard of it, even though they lived a tenth of a mile away from it. That probably wouldn't have surprised Sam Bush, who books the concerts at the Garage.
The Garage is doing something that's really special. But how do you share that with someone who hasn't been to one of these shows? And then out of nowhere, Forrest and Zaina Pando come along.
Sam saw the Pando's first video, called them, and asked if they'd be interested in filming more bands coming through the Garage. The catch? He couldn't really pay them.
And we all kind of giggled,
And then they said yes.
It was something that Forrest and I had already wanted to do, these kind of like live takeaway music videos. And then on top of it, Sam had the access to the bands.
That's good. That was 18 months ago.
You ready, Forrest?
Yeah.
Okay. Since then, Sam and the Pandos have been collaborating on 2 or 3 video sessions a month. Today they're filming a Florida band called This Frontier Needs Heroes.
Well, some say if you don't like it, that you better leave.
Once it's edited, this video will join 25 others on a website called GarageVideoSessions.com. Sam loves it.
I mean, it's amazing. I think Forrest and Zaina could be charging thousands of dollars for these videos. I mean, it's really good content, and they're doing it for free. And I feel like I'm getting away with murder.
Most of the videos feature acoustic bands, often performing in iconic locations around Charlottesville, like the Blue Moon Diner or the Christchurch Bell Tower. Some videos, like the one featuring North Carolina's Holy Ghost Tent Revival performing on the Pedestrian Mall, are foot-stomping, head-bopping pleasures. Other Garage video sessions are lovely and lyrical, like the one that features singer-songwriter Devin Sproul singing in a canoe on a lake.
Say it again. I couldn't hear you. Shall I come nearer to you?
Some of the Garage video sessions are approaching 20,000 views online now, and a couple have even received some national press attention on the websites of Rolling Stone, The Village Voice, and The Wall Street Journal, among others. The Pandos are, of course, delighted by that attention, but what really drives them is something else entirely. Creative freedom.
I don't think that's something that would have come if we were getting paid per video. It's led to it really becoming something that we're proud of.
I think that we could have only dreamed of that when we first started. So,
but if you wind it all backwards, all of this is because when we were editing and got a little bored, we walked downstairs and started to film. And that has kind of led to where we are now, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Good job, you guys. That was great.
For WMRA News, I'm Emily Richardson-Lorente.
Co-housing, or living in an intentional community while still retaining your own home, is a trend that has recently begun taking off in Virginia. Carol Lofton talked to one of the organizers of the Harrisonburg Co-Housing Initiative, and she visited an active co-housing community in Blacksburg.
The idea of adults intentionally living in a community of houses that were built to face one another with pedestrian walkways, community gardens, and a children's playground in the middle struck me as either brilliant, why aren't all communities built this way, or some kind of weird commune.
The idea of co-housing is to better balance privacy that we are used to with the community that we're lacking in general in our lives.
That was Karina Young, one of the organizers for the Harrisonburg co-housing movement. Harrisonburg Co-Housing is one of five burgeoning communities in Virginia that are still in the planning stages. A public presentation about co-housing in Virginia is scheduled for Saturday at Richmond's Artworks in Virginia and will include representatives from the five new communities, two in Richmond and one each in Floyd, Crozet, and Harrisonburg.
So the people who tend to be attracted to this idea tend to be kind of cultural creatives, people who often think a little bit outside the box, and who value their privacy but are interested in having a sense of community also.
Because of the financial requirements of joining the community, all houses are privately owned, it does tend to end up being a middle-class neighborhood, she said.
Most co-housing communities have clustered housing, so all the housing is close together on one part of the property. Even if they have 20 acres, all of the housing is still on about 3 acres. And there are all of the parking. Cars are de-emphasized, so the parking is on the outside of the neighborhood, and there are pedestrian paths that go in between the houses.
There is no selection process for being a part of a community, nor are most communities religiously affiliated. However, new residents must agree to the tenets of the homeowners association, which usually includes paying dues to preserve common space and encouraging residents to actively participate in physical maintenance of the community. In Harrisonburg, Young and her family are one of five local households committed to the project. They are in the process of negotiating for a piece of land in the city and are hoping to attract an additional 15 to 20 households. One day, it may look something like Shadow Lake, an almost 15-year-old co-housing community in Blacksburg. Lisa Poley, a co-housing consultant, lives there. We're in the lobby of the common house at Shadow Lake.
Almost all co-housing communities have sort of the core components that you see here, like a large, what we call great room, which can be used for meals, it can be used for entertainment, it can be used for parties, any number of things. Hi. So now we have it set up for the community meal, but like we can push all the tables to the side. We have, you know, music or whatever. And then we purposely have, this is like supposed to be soundproof glass.
She points at a window in the back of the great room. Through it, a nursery-type playroom is visible.
So the kids eat in about 5 minutes and then start yelling and making noise. And so they have a place that they can go and do that and still have the visual connection with parents, but then you can still have adult conversation.
At a kitchen on the other end of the great room, volunteers are making the weekly optional community meal. Community members who want to participate pay about $5 a head to partake. On the menu tonight, lentil soup, grilled cheese, and apple crisp. Back outside, it's a beautiful evening. Children run down the green space in the middle of a row of houses to the playground. A woman walks her dog toward the paths that wind through wooded acreage and connect with a local community park. Three men, including Polly's husband Will, sit on the front porch of a house in front of the swing set. They welcomed us to join them while we wait for the meal to begin.
Hi. I'm Kara. I'm from WMRA.
Fred.
Oh,
nice to meet you.
Kristen.
Nice to meet you.
Fred.
Will.
Will.
Yeah.
Will Stacy and fellow co-housers Fred Mignon and Kristen Marquis talked enthusiastically at length about what they love about co-housing. Then, at my prompting, about the challenges of dealing with conflict, negotiating strong personalities, and learning that in a community like theirs, personal actions can have group consequences.
You can't hide, right? So who you are is it's going
to
be out there.
Your rough edges shown,
you know,
to you.
It's going to be out there. And you got, you know, honestly, to grow relationships, right, you have to take risks. Yeah? So you have to be honest and I mean, that's the toughest thing, is to continually do it for, you know, 15, 20 years.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
This summer, people across Virginia and the nation were shocked when Virginia reporters Allison Parker and Adam Ward were shot to death on live TV. But will the national outrage lead to any action on Capitol Hill? Virginia Public Radio's Matt Laszlo tries to answer that question in this report from Washington.
A few weeks after his daughter Allison was killed by a mentally unstable coworker, Andy Parker came to the Capitol to call on lawmakers to expand background checks for gun purchasers.
I come here still in a state of raw and consuming grief. And I'm not here because I want to be here. I'm here because I have to be here. Yes. I'm here because Allison would want me to be here. And in fact, she would insist that I would be here because that's the kind of amazing young woman my daughter was.
Since the Virginia slaying, 9 students were killed and another 9 injured in Oregon at a mass shooting at a community college. That's got Democrats once again calling for Republicans to take up gun control. This is nothing new. In the wake of the slaying of 26 school children and educators in Newtown, Connecticut, Democrats formed a House Gun Safety Task Force. Virginia Congressman Bobby Scott served as its vice chairman.
We came up with many recommendations, such as enhanced background checks, a limit on the size of magazines, more mental health, more prevention. We made those recommendations over a year ago, and the Republican Congress hadn't taken them up.
Most of those recommendations would have to go through the House Judiciary Committee, which is chaired by Virginia Republican Bob Goodlatte. His district is home to the TV station where the slain TV reporters worked. At a recent press conference, Goodlatte was asked if he plans to hold a hearing on gun control.
Well, we are very concerned about gun violence in the country, and we are looking at measures like making sure that employers who know, referring specifically to the case you cited in my district, who know that someone may have anger issues, even violence issues, is reported down the line.
Goodlatte's staff says no hearings have been scheduled to look into gun violence. The chairman says he supports reforms to the mental health system, but that new gun laws aren't necessary.
But my opinion is that we need to have greater enforcement of the myriad of gun laws that we already have on the books.
Mental health reform seems like the one area where Democrats and Republicans can agree at this point. Virginia Republican Congressman Morgan Griffith says mental health reform is a state issue. But he says he's been in dialogue with lawmakers in Richmond about setting up a procedure to have guns confiscated from people who a court finds shouldn't have a firearm.
I don't say that lightly. I'm a big gun supporter.
Griffith says it's not a novel idea.
Just like when an officer pulls somebody over and recognizes that, you know, it's really not probably wise for them to still have a driver's license. They have to go get a medical exam and see a judge about it before they can get their license back. Because, you know, maybe they can't see anymore.
While Democrats are on board with mental health reform, they're also pushing for enhancing the nation's background check system. Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says it's essential.
We learned the shooting at Virginia Tech would have been stopped by a better background record check system. Right. And we learn again and again, the better background check system you have, the safer you are.
Democrats realize they don't control either chamber of Congress, so they're trying to make gun control a central issue in the 2016 elections. But it's unclear if they can counter the powerful lobbying efforts by gun rights groups across the nation. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Governor Terry McAuliffe signed an executive order earlier this week giving local law enforcement more resources to prosecute gun crimes. It's part of a push by the governor to do what he can to crack down on gun violence in the state. Virginia Public Radio's Mallory No Payne reports.
The order creates a joint task force focusing on how better to enforce gun laws already on the books in the state.
We are going to come after you, and we are going to prosecute you.
Flanked by the parents of Allison Parker, the WDBJ television reporter who, along with her coworker Adam Ward, was murdered at gunpoint in August. McAuliffe announced that, with the exception of law enforcement, all firearms would be banned from state executive offices.
We should not wait for the next tragedy to occur to identify places where there is no justifiable need to carry a firearm.
McAuliffe has attempted to pass similar measures through the Republican-controlled legislature unsuccessfully. But upcoming elections could change which party controls the state Senate. In Richmond, I'm Mallory No Payne.
Finally, there's been strong public opposition to plans for a pipeline to carry natural gas from the fracking fields of West Virginia through Virginia. Now, Dominion Virginia Power says it will change the path of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, a change that could affect property owners in Augusta County. And Mallory Nopain has that report.
Deciding where the pipeline would travel in Virginia has been a contentious process, with many people in its path objecting. Some fear construction or a leak could contaminate public water supplies, and Dominion has agreed to make a change.
This is a map of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline proposed route in the Waynesboro-Lyndhurst area.
In his office in Richmond, Dominion spokesman Jim Norville describes a five-mile change.
In various meetings over the past year with the Augusta County Service Authority, the authority let us know that this area is basically a large well, and it serves a purpose for being a recharge area for its water systems. And they really wanted us to avoid going through here.
The new route will go through 30 properties it hadn't before. Dominion has sent letters to those property owners requesting permission to survey the land and see if it's suitable. For an individual property owner, what does that look like tangibly on my property?
Sure. The pipeline is 42 inches in diameter. It'll be buried about 10 feet deep. You can still use your property for farming or for raising cattle or for recreational purposes. If it is a forested area, then there would be a clearing roughly about 75 feet at permanent once that the pipeline is built. That would have to be maintained, again, for the pipeline safety.
Dominion is hoping to send out survey crews as soon as possible and then take the change to a federal agency, which has final say on the route. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. You'll find all of the stories from the WMRA newsroom at WMRA.org. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.